I'll call the meeting to order, and the Senate's doing a much better job of getting our people here than the House, but the House is up for election.
You have a reason. You have a reason, yes.
And since I'm not running for re-election, I can be here. I wanted to remind you that you've received the worksheet. Commission members. That is this is a sort of just a worksheet on what we need to do. And remember, we're supposed to have a report by the end of December to recommend to the legislature what we think they should be doing in terms of the healthcare workforce. So just look at that worksheet, and we'll have some discussion of that today. Mark, do you have any comments you want to make?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of updates before we dive into our panel presentations. Just on your point about the commission schedule for the rest of the year, today members will begin their first discussion of possible recommendations. There will be one more meeting dedicated to that kind of discussion on November 18th. We're hoping to produce a draft by the end of the month, early December. You'll have a meeting on December 11th to discuss the draft, and a final meeting on December 18th to take action on the draft. So that's where we are at. You do have in your materials a minutes or notes document from the last meeting. We've been compiling, I think, more complete, more extensive notes than often here, and if you want to take action on these, you probably can't have had time to read them, but we can do that next time. These will be very helpful resources as we start to put together the first draft of the report. Work continues at the staff level on the healthcare, education, and investment state spending compilation that how staff is contributing to. Nothing new to show you today, but again, that is all headed towards inclusion in the draft report, and work on that continues. One item of interest to put on your radar, and we will send members an invitation to this event. I think it was at the last meeting you heard from the chair of the Foreign Physician Task Force, Dr. Edwin Baganko. Dr. Baganko and that task force are scheduling an evening meeting to get together and hear from the community, the group of foreign physicians in Minnesota. It'll be a pretty broad discussion. They're hoping for a good turnout. It's November 10th, starting at 6 at the International Institute on Como, across from the state fairgrounds, and we will get you all the details of that. They did want to expressly invite commission members to that event. One final update as we begin regarding a document that is in your materials. You might want to pull it out. It's called Changes in Healthcare Profession Scope of Practice Legislative Considerations. Again, a reference material as you reference piece as you look at recommendations and think about the work of the commission over the next 2 years, if I could just maybe spend a moment on that. If you turn to page 5 of this document and look in the background paragraph, you'll see that this was prepared with legislatures and legislators in mind by the National Association of 6 state licensing boards: medicine, nursing, occupational therapy, pharmacy, physical therapy, and social work, as a background document for state legislatures. They acknowledge the context, the landscape on page 7, where in the legislature, scope issues sometimes pit one profession against another. And they go on, I'll draw your attention specifically to the principles that they lay out starting on page 9, where they begin, of course, with putting in top priority the public protection purpose of regulation, but they then go on to acknowledge that changes in scope are inherent with the changing healthcare system. Collaboration between providers should be the norm. Overlap among professions is necessary. And finally, that on the following page, number 5, that state practice acts should be based on demonstrated competency and training with any legislation considered. So again, I think it's a useful background document to consider and digest, you know, perhaps in the quiet interim before actual bills get in front of you, and commission may want to use it over the next couple of years as well. And those are the updates that I have. I don't know if, Lucy, you have any updates or anybody else?
Okay. Thank you. And I will say that the scope of practice is very controversial when it gets into the legislature. Across state line, licensing is also an issue that the MMA is interested in. And if you look at our state, we have lots of physicians in North and South Dakota that are treating people in the western part of our state. And in my particular area, we have physicians in Duluth that are also treating people in Wisconsin. And how do you do the licensing for those kinds of things? And particularly if we get into telemedicine, and which is definitely coming, then you also get into licensing issues across state lines. And you look at Mayo. They do southwestern Wisconsin, a lot of Iowa, and so they do all kinds of things across state lines. So those issues are coming. They're going to be controversial, but I think we need to deal with them. And so why don't we start then with the...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was taking a look at the agenda today, and then I was comparing it to our Table 5 education and occupation list. And so I've seen a lot today on the medical doctors, and I've heard from them before. One of the concerns I have is that we're workforce, not just doctor. And so I'm concerned that we've heard a lot from a physician side, but the workforce is more than the doctors. Right. So there's physician assistants, there's... advanced practice registered nurses. There's just a whole list here, so I won't go through them all. And so as a workforce, it's broader than just medical doctors, and I look forward to the agenda today, but I'm just wondering if maybe we could add some time to have, like today you have your some medical students and residents, which I think is great. I really look forward to hearing, because they're the ones right in the flow right now. They're facing it. And I would love to do the same thing for some of the other workforce students as well. I think they would give valuable insight, but I'd like it to be broader than just medical doctors. Would that be possible to do that for the next
meeting?
Sure,
we can do that, and that's a good point. We did hear from, a couple of meetings ago from the people that run the physician assistant programs, the advanced practice nursing programs, the nursing programs.
On the teacher side, excuse me, yes.
Yeah, and if you look at what's happening nationally, it's the team approach is mm-hmm. what's being talked about and being implemented all over this country, and Minnesota's in the lead, of course. but that is the interaction between physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, RNs, and if you get into the mental health area, you have psychologists and social workers, and they're all part of a system. And trying to integrate that is the thing. One of the things we need to do, and it's mm-hmm. hasn't been done very well in the past.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Next meeting, we can add that rest of the workforce. I think that would be good. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Before we move on to just on the scope of practice, because I think this is a useful exercise going through some of these changes that are coming. I mean, and actually when we had that group up there, one of the biggest things that they said is, well, we don't really know what a healthcare team is going to look like in the future, and it is certainly going to be more than docs. And the list of principles around evaluating scope of practice is one that I think that everybody in every single scope of practice, battle royale around this place could embrace. And so they're instructive, but they can be used both in favor of any given change and in opposition. And I think one of the key pieces is a little further into here, Section C is regarding evidence. And I think one of the key pieces as legislators is to try to ferret out how to, in a better way, evaluate evidence-based research and figure out how to measure that. It's actually only a half of a page in here. It's not going to give a great deal of insights. But I think that the principles are widely embraced, that we need to have every profession operating at the top of their license within that scope that they can safely and effectively provide to patients, but how do we as legislators work through the evidence to make a determination? That's what we are constantly faced with. So that's just a comment as we think through this and as we find that time to digest this, pay particular attention to how we as a legislature try to weigh that evidence. That's the tricky part in my mind.
I can give you an example. In my second term, the optometrist wanted to be authorized to make prescriptions for certain eye diseases. And, of course, the ophthalmologists were violently opposed to that. And it took us 4 or 5 years to get that passed. And the clinic I go to, all they had was ophthalmologists. And now, 20 years later, most of the general eye work is done by optometrists, and the ophthalmologists do the surgery. So there's been a huge change in how eye care is delivered, at least in the clinic that I go to. But change is tough. So any other comments? Then let's go on to a hearing from the medical students and medical residents, Christy Johnson, Peter Myers, and Dr. John Reich.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Perhaps just as they're making their way forward, again, also for your reference in your materials today, is an article that caught my eye recently from a periodical called Why I'm Becoming a Primary Care Doctor. I think we're going to hear a lot of that from this panel, but again, when they're perhaps again when you're going through your materials later, I'd just call this one to your attention too.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. And why don't you, when you start to talk, give us your name so we know who you are. And this is all being recorded too, so it helpful to
get
your names.
All right, I can start. Thank you for having me. I'm John Reich. I'm a GI fellow, first year GI fellow, gastroenterology at the university. My background is that I grew up in Red Wing, and I went to college at the university here, and I got a biomedical engineering degree. But I wasn't real passionate about it. I did some volunteering at a hospital, and so I subsequently applied to medical school. Wanted to be a physician, and went to medical school up in Duluth for the first 2 years, and then came down to the Twin Cities for the second two. Then did internal medicine residency at the university. And did a chief resident year at the VA in quality improvement and patient safety focus. And then now I'm a first-year GI fellow. I also am married to another physician from International Falls, who we met in Duluth. And she's in dermatology. So I have a little different perspective about, you know, what I think led us maybe potentially astray from primary care. But so when I started at Duluth, I was certainly thinking that family practice primary care was something that I would enjoy doing. I didn't have a lot of experience other than the volunteer work I'd done and directly with working with patients and things. But and I want to say that Duluth, there's no better place to learn for the first 2 years of medical school. It's just amazing. And the focus on family practice is great. The experiences I had, I think, that started to kind of push me away from the primary care family practice focus was that we did some various shadowing and clerkships and things with folks in outstate practices, and it seemed like the physicians that I was tasked to be around just didn't seem as passionate about their work. I mean, it just seemed like there was frustrations about like length of appointments, paperwork. It seemed like they were doing a job, and for an impressionable medical student, especially in the first 2 years of medical school, being passionate about what you're doing, I think, is extremely important. And so I kind of walked away from those experiences with, well, I'm not sure that this is what I want to do. And I did a rotation in GI at Hennepin County Medical Center, and it seemed like people were just having a terrific time, you know, a lot of teaching, and the experience was great. That I do enjoy a little bit of hands-on, you know, in medicine, a little bit of, shame to say, a little instant gratification, you know, as well with the procedural aspects of it. But and so I did rotate with an internist in the Twin Cities who was very passionate about what he was doing and had terrific relationships with his patients, but was in a small group practice and was worried about being phased out by the requirements for documentation and billing and Medicare and things like this. And it was really, despite how much he loved what he was doing, he was worried that he may not be able to go on much longer, to be honest, without joining into a larger group and having less independence. So I went into internal medicine thinking, still, maybe I could do primary care, but leaning more toward gastroenterology. And my continuity clinic experience in my residency was, there just wasn't a lot of continuity, to be honest. And so there wasn't a lot of relationship development. And I think that that's really important, too, for medical students and residents to develop relationships with patients. And I don't know that I got a lot of that good experiences with my personal experience. And you know, my wife was similar with the outstate experiences she had in Duluth, whereas a lot of our classmates, especially ones who went into family practice, had terrific experiences with people who were passionate about what they were doing. So I think that was a major factor. Other things that, you know, made primary care a little bit more less appealing that I have here. It's kind of intimidating, I think, primary care, because it seems like you have to know everything. You treat, you know, somebody can walk in the door with anything wrong. And I think that for me, that was just somewhat intimidating. You know, it seems to be that there's, in some places, there's increased pressure to produce and less time with patients. I think that that's probably about consistent across all fields of medicine, but it seems to maybe be hitting hard, at least in my personal experience with primary care. You know, the attitudes of medical students, the admissions process with medical school, it's really competitive. And so you're basically competing to get a spot in this medical school. And when you get to medical school, the message that you hear a lot is, if you get this grade, or if you're in the top 10%, or if you get this board score, then you get to do plastic surgery, dermatology. And so sometimes for a lot of medical students, I think it's hard to turn off that competitive drive to say, well, maybe if I don't necessarily want to do dermatology, but if I'm the best, then I can. You know, it's kind of a driving factor instead of making sort of all of these things more sort of equal. And then I think debt was a big thing. And between my wife and I, you know, we're approaching a half of $1 million in debt, and with a mortgage, and we have a couple kids. I'm not saying that doctors don't make enough money in primary care, but I think that it's just the idea of having this gigantic debt, and am I going to do, you know, the specialty with the various, I mean, the income gap, as I think the panel, I understand, already knows very well that there's a significant income gap. It certainly plays a role in some decision-making, I think. And I don't think that anyone goes to medical school to say that I'm going to get rich. I hope not. But it certainly plays a role. So we were asked to maybe have some potential recommendations for the committee, and I'm not sure that anything I'm going to say is going to be groundbreaking, but I think that more strong loan forgiveness programs, potentially, for people going into primary care. I think if primary care family practice physicians didn't have to pay off loans, I think that would absolutely be a good incentive. I think that seeking out motivated and passionate preceptors, especially in my experience, and I don't know, that can't be a very easy thing, but at least thinking about how to do that best. And then a lot of my friends from medical school, some of them, three went into orthopedic surgery, one in neurosurgery, myself in GI, my wife in dermatology, all from Duluth. We're all going to go back to small communities. I hope that might ease some of the vitriol in the room. So I do think that recruiting specifically, you know, if you want people to go to smaller communities, I do anecdotally think that getting people from smaller places may help get people to go back to smaller communities. That's all I have.
Could you just explain, you do how many years in internal medicine, and then how many years after that to become a GI?
Sure. Yep, I did. The internal medicine is 3 years, and after that you could go on to be a primary care physician or like a hospitalist. I did a chief year, which was one additional year, and now the GI fellowship is 3 additional years, so I'll be seven years out from starting medical school.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any, so who's next?
Good morning.
Move over a little closer to the mic.
Okay. There you go.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My name is Christy Johnson. I'm a fourth-year medical student at the University of Minnesota. I also did my first 2 years of medical school at the Duluth campus. I was asked to give a little information about my background and then also any recommendations I could have that might be helpful for the committee. I recently sent out my residency applications for family medicine. I'm specifically looking for family medicine programs with strong procedural and OB training so that I'll be prepared to practice in a rural area with OB and C-section training. So my background, I was...
Could I ask just a question while I'm thinking of it? The C-sections, family practice docs don't normally do that, is that correct?
That's true, especially in cities. But where I want to practice and where I've done my RPAP training, which is a rural program, and I'll mention that. It's in smaller towns where there isn't the population to support a full-time obstetrician to do the C-section training. So the C-sections are performed by family doctors and the maybe one or two general surgeons that are on staff. But there's not that many programs left in the country that still offer it in 3 years. So my background, I was born and raised in rural Wisconsin, just outside of Superior, just south of Superior, and I went to Superior High School across the bridge from Duluth, Minnesota. I was raised in a blue-collar family. My father is an auto mechanic, and he delivers to the Duluth News Tribune. My mother works for the Duluth Transit Authority in Duluth, the local bus company. I'm the oldest of four kids. We were raised in a tiny two-bedroom farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere, and our family income was right at or around the poverty line. I received free or reduced school lunch for my public education. I decided that I wanted to be a doctor at a pretty young age. My best friend's father was a physician, and he's the only physician I knew really well growing up, and he was a family doc. And he was very supportive and always, I'll always consider him a benefactor for supporting me when I was younger. I didn't have any physicians in my family or anything to get inspiration from, but I was supported by my own family as well. After high school, I graduated from Superior High School, which has 460 students in my class. The graduation rate is about 75% only at that high school. With the help of some scholarships, and I received the Pell Grant and the Wisconsin Higher Education Grant for low-income students, I was able to go to UW-Madison. I graduated there with zoology and English majors. Following that, I lived in New York City for a few years. I was married. I had one child. I did AmeriCorps and worked with physicians and decided and just continued to believe that medicine was where I wanted to go. It was the career that I really wanted to do, and I really never considered any other career path other than family medicine when it came to medical, and I'm not 100% sure why. It's maybe because that was my only experience, but nothing else really swayed me towards it. After 4 years after graduating from college, I was accepted to the University of Minnesota Duluth Medical School. I'll admit that I was accepted after applying three times. It was my third time that I was finally accepted. I had interviewed 2 years prior, and I know the only reason I was really even allowed to interview there and was eventually accepted was because of my strong desire to practice family medicine, especially rural family medicine. I even mentioned Laura Ingalls Wilder on my personal statement. So I was throwing all my balls in one corner there. And so and the reason that I wasn't as competitive as my other students, as my peers, was my science GPA wasn't as high as theirs, and as you'd mentioned, it's crazy competitive to get into medical school. My MCAT scores were not as competitive as a lot of the people around me, and I know that because I wasn't offered interviews at a lot of other schools. I was only offered a few interviews, and they were places with family medicine, rural focus. Once I was accepted at the University of Minnesota Duluth, I was just welcomed wholeheartedly. I always felt super supported the whole time I was there. It felt like all the doors finally opened to me, and no longer was I trying to convince people that I could do it, but I had a group of faculty behind me that believed that I could do it, and they were really supporting my desire to go into family medicine. While I was there, I was able to follow some very, I was able to shadow and then work with some very motivated family doctors who seemed very passionate about what they were doing. They mentioned the challenges that were facing family doctors, but they were always mentioning how they were overcoming those challenges and giving me tips for what to do in the future and what to look for in my future practices. I think that also supported me, and that was probably one of the reasons I never really considered another specialty path. During my third year of medical school, I was accepted to the RPAP program, which is the Rural Physician Associate Program. I spent 9 months working with primarily one family doctor in Moose Lake, Minnesota, and I was able to really see his practice and see his family life and see how where his standing was in his city, and I just knew that that was something that I wanted to do. My husband agreed that that was where he wanted us to live someday, and where to raise our children was in a small town like that, where the family docs provide the majority of the medical care. That's basically where I am up to this point. For recommendations that I would give, I think that the reimbursements for loans is, of course, important, but it's been mentioned. Based on my own background, coming from, I like to say blue-collar, for lack of a better word, background, I think that if we can promote more high school students and pre-medical undergraduate students, regardless of their background, but people that are really interested in family medicine, the way I was interested in family medicine, I never steered. Like, I wanted to do it always. And once I was given the opportunity to go to medical school, I just needed that shot. So I feel like if we can create more programs for helping students from a younger age and really supporting them, and because applying to medical school is not something that takes 9 months. It is years in the making, and you find out very quick and on the interview trail that if you don't have the research behind you and the MCAT scores behind you and a lot of other things, you're just not going to be as competitive. And for someone who doesn't have certain resources or certain connections, they would never know to look for those. So I, in my future practice, I hope to be able to mentor young people who are interested in family medicine and people that maybe didn't think of it as an option, and supporting them right from the beginning, because I think that you'll get a lot of family docs out of that. From my high school, I'm not in touch with everyone, but as far as I know, out of 460 students, there's nobody else in my class who's pursued medicine. There are some nurse practitioners and some nurses, but nobody's gone to medical school, and that's a pretty large class to not have anyone go to medical school, and I don't know anyone ahead of me or below me either. I'm sure there's a couple, but if there were programs when we were younger that really promoted it and recruited us, I think that would make a big difference. That's all I have.
Thank you. And are there questions? I will say that one of the things we're looking at is ways to encourage people to be interested in medical schools. And that starts at an earlier age than most of us have had to deal with. Any questions? Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not so much a question, but your story really resonated with me. My nephews live just south of Superior. I go to Moose Lake for my primary care. I was just there to see my doctor a couple of weeks ago. Superior High School is a challenging one to come out of and do really well, is what, the experiences I'm familiar with. And so thank you for your persistence. It seemed like you really were determined and jumped a lot of hurdles to get where you are today. And I think that you're going to, from everything I hear, you're going to go out and do a lot of really good work and add a lot of value to some small community, and I hope it is Moose Lake. And I'll ask you afterwards which doctor you worked with. I know all of them there and consider them all, most of them, friends.
Yeah, any other questions? Senator Clausen.
Thank you. My background is in the high school principal and teacher for many years, and I was glad that you brought up the fact that perhaps we need to start earlier with informing students about a career path in the medical field. And one of the recommendations in our draft is to look at providing grants to schools throughout Minnesota for Project Lead the Way, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a nonprofit organization. They sponsor STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and math, and they have a whole series of biomedical courses that students can take. They're very rigorous. There's a lot of training for the teachers that are involved. It's a very hands-on course, so I appreciate your comments that connected with that, because that's something I've been thinking of as well. So thank you, and thank you for your persistence.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and we'll go to Mr. Myers.
Yeah, that leaves me. Mr. Chair, committee members, I really appreciate this opportunity, so thank you. My name is Peter Myers. I'm in my final year of an MD-MPH program here at the U. And I'm here today because I wrote an op-ed back in April that Mark saw recently. And that op-ed was a plea for the creation of this commission. So I'm hopeful that you guys will take a real serious look at the
I read that article one. I have it upstairs.
Oh, wow. That's good to hear. Thank you. I'm hopeful that we can take a real serious look at this system and come up with a thoughtful set of recommendations. I'm also hopeful I'm hopeful about the future of primary care. I think about that future a lot. And I spend a lot of time talking to my friends and colleagues about that future and why they should be optimistic as well. But I don't want to wait either. I submit my residency rank list in February, which will have a significant impact on what kind of a doctor I will become. And kind of conveniently, that's a month or so after this commission submits its final report. So I will certainly be paying attention to what you guys decide to do, and it will likely have an impact on my decision and the decision of many other of my classmates. So I started med school in 2010. Like Christy, it was also not my first attempt. I had applied a few years earlier, and I knew I wanted to do primary care. I knew I wanted to do family medicine, and it didn't happen for me. So I went back to the drawing board and did some more extracurricular stuff and community stuff and really tried to make it clear that I was committed to this career. Shortly after starting med school, though, I found myself really disengaged. I was sitting in the backs of classrooms, watching PowerPoints melt into one another. I'm sure you guys can relate to that here. Learning objectives, diagrams, take-home messages. Dark classroom after dark classroom. I didn't feel inspired. I was literally in the dark and figuratively in the dark about what I was going to do, how I could contribute to the medical field. In the back of that classroom, I also thought about the two family medicine physicians in North Carolina who told me not to go into medicine, and God forbid I go into primary care. So at that point, I was a senior in college, an undergrad, a pre-med, and enrolled in a course that gave me the opportunity to shadow physicians and see what my future career might look like. It was a shocking and disheartening moment, to say the least. These physicians who were doing my dream job were telling me to reevaluate everything I had thought about my career, my life. Fast forward again to that dark classroom, and I was thinking, you know, maybe they had been right all along. So halfway through my third year, I started family medicine rotation at United Family Medicine, who you're going to hear from in a little bit, in St. Paul. It changed my life. They showed me that a group of passionate, engaged physicians could make a significant impact in a community. They showed me what it was really like to be a leader, how to incorporate population health and advocacy tools into your daily practice, and how to change lives in a difficult and complicated outpatient setting. That same month, I met a young physician named Andrew Morris Singer, who started an advocacy organization called Primary Care Progress. He started that as a resident in 2009 at Harvard. At this point, in 2012, he gave an exciting grand rounds presentation to the Department of Family Medicine, and I got pumped up to go start a local chapter of this group. It opened my eyes to this massive network of interprofessional students who were interested in primary care revitalization, exactly what you guys are talking about and have been talking about all summer. So this organization is dedicated to teaching leadership, advocacy, community organizing skills for the next generation of primary care leaders so that they can take it to the next step, to the next level. I've also had the opportunity to work for Primary Care Progress as a clinical innovation fellow during my last year of med school, so right now. The fellowship has allowed me to work with and learn from some of the most creative and innovative people in primary care. I've also been able to expose other students to exciting developments in primary care, help them understand the importance of clinical innovation, and teach them leadership skills that we aren't taught in med school. this experience, along with my experience at United, is what reinvigorated my passion for primary care. But I'm still on the fence. My entire med school has been focused on family medicine. But I just finished my MPH this last spring, and it was focused in health policy. And I'm interested in public health and health policy. And I'm worried about my ability to balance a robust primary care practice with that interest in health policy. So I'm considering the idea of being a pediatric hospitalist. I've always loved working with kids, and that's something I loved about family medicine. But I don't know. I don't know if it's going to fit the way that I want it to. So in the eyes of the state, pediatrics is still a primary care specialty. And I'd be eligible for loan forgiveness and programs that might help with the debt burden. But I wouldn't be practicing primary care. The schedule of a hospitalist is way different than a family medicine doctor. You've got more time to pursue some interests because of those schedule differences. And so that seems to fit really well. But it's not exactly that clear for me. So in my position with Primary Care Progress, I routinely meet these inspiring primary care providers who are in the trenches doing the real work to move this system forward. And that connects to both my head and my heart. It's logical to me to work in the field that will be the foundation of a healthcare system that provides the most important functions. And hopefully, but likely naively, our state will realize that primary care providers need to be valued as the centerpiece of an effective healthcare system. It also makes sense to me emotionally because I've seen the inspiring power of a good primary care provider. So Dr. Tim Rumsey, who works at United Family Medicine, was a mentor, preceptor of mine while I was doing that rotation. And he is a special physician. He's done wonders for a man that I'll call Dean. So I met Dean on this rotation, a number of chronic issues, COPD, hypertension, hepatitis C, anxiety, and traumatic brain injury. He also has a history of homelessness and alcoholism and drug abuse. And Dean needed a lot of help with medications and with forms and just a lot of issues. Dr. Rumsey had 16 people on his schedule that day, which was actually a little bit light for him, but that's about 15 to 20 minutes per patient, and Dean needed more than that. Knowing this, Dr. Rumsey went into the room and sat down like they were on a bench in a park with nothing else to do. And he spent an hour with Dean, and he only had 15 minutes. But he got his medications lined up, he got paperwork signed, he got everything in order. He listened to Dean talk about his issues. And Dr. Rumsey didn't get paid for an hour. He got paid for 15 minutes. He didn't get paid to help coordinate his care with a social worker. He didn't get paid to talk to Dean about local resources and to listen to Dean's goals. But Dr. Rumsey gave him 60 minutes. And physicians around the state do that routinely. That's every day. And he did that because he needed Dean to feel comfortable in the clinic so that he would come back instead of returning to his vices that left him on the streets of St. Paul previously. And that's what good primary care is. It's doing the things for your patient that need to be done in spite of a system that doesn't reward you for doing it. I've also met a bunch of inspiring people right here in Minnesota, U of M students, physicians. The Duluth campus is acutely focused on this issue, as we talked about. HCMC is one of the most innovative clinics in the entire country. But these passionate professionals don't have the resources they need to keep up with the volume of patient care, paperwork, and the daily grind of being a primary care doctor. They don't have the incentives or the outright demands or encouragement from the public to fight for those changes. So most programs, most residency programs, receive a ton of federal money, but they churn out a lot of specialists, and I'm not trying to be offensive in any way. but they contribute to this current dilemma. And so a lot of programs don't even track where their residents go. So here at the U, we lump internal medicine, family medicine, and peds into one category. But in reality, only 18% of internal medicine doctors go on to practice primary care. And only 30% of pediatricians go on to practice real primary care. So that's not really cutting it. And despite that federal funding, the programs in primary care are still underfunded. And it dissuades residents from going into those programs. So we're at this crossroads, and you guys are well aware of this. We've been here for years. The training programs are underfunded, the physicians are overworked, financial incentives aren't aligned, students are choosing more lucrative fields, and we've lost a generation, or maybe two generations, of really good primary care doctors to the subspecialists. And you should know that most medical students come into medical school thinking they want to do primary care. At least they say that on their personal statement. They know that admissions committees are looking for that. But the combination of overburdened practices, high burnout, huge debt, low pay, kind of force them to change their mind. So there are literally hundreds of studies across the world at multiple levels that have shown that healthcare systems based on public health and primary care achieve better outcomes with greater equity at lower costs. And I'd be happy to share any of those papers with you guys. But we don't have the political will to improve that bedrock of our system. So I want to impress upon you that I don't want those two physicians in North Carolina to be right. And I don't want to end up like them in 15 years, worn down by the realities of political inertia, telling students not to enter this career or the field that they've been dreaming about since they were a kid. So I'm really asking you to put forth a serious and thoughtful set of recommendations that will strengthen our state's commitment to primary care and public health. We know the answer. We know it. It's a greater investment in this stuff, primary care and public health. The health of our state and lives of future Minnesotans depend on it, and you guys hold the key. This commission could make a real difference, so don't pass up this opportunity. I have a couple of thoughts I can go through, but I know I'm probably over time, so if we don't want to, that's fine. Okay. If you're interested, that's okay. Okay, I'll be quick.
Thank you. Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was hoping to get to his recommendations.
Yeah. Sorry, I know, that went on too long. I'll be quick. Thank you for acting. Senator Kiffmeyer. So I wanted to start by saying that you guys could seek a few more opportunities to speak with pre-med students and first-year students. I know I've talked to a few of you and I've seen you around the med school, but they are not hard to find, and they will show up almost anywhere with free food. I can guarantee it from experience. I encourage them to enter primary care and public health. Tell them about the importance of a strong healthcare system built on these things. And tell them the things that you will do to support their aspirations and to support their future career. We can also arrange for funding to be tied to tracking where their graduates go from residency. But it needs to be at 5 years after graduating. At 5 years, it's a much better predictor about where they will actually practice than the residency that they choose. The residency is just the first step. There are lots of steps after that. So we could also talk about transformation within those residency programs. That's the sweet spot. You've got the next generation being trained, simultaneously treating a high percentage of Medicaid patients, which are some of the most expensive and complicated patients in the state. And you're getting both of them for your dollar. So these residency programs need that investment from grants and enhanced payments. We've talked a lot about mentoring. We could support physicians who precept and mentor, like Georgia just did. Georgia just passed a thing that provides state tax credits for physicians in rural communities to take a med student and precept them. And they can make up to $1,000 a month in tax credits, which is pretty significant. We've talked about eliminating disparities in clinical earnings, and I'm not going to say that physicians don't make a lot of money either. I'm aware of that, but there's just a huge gap that you guys know about. We've talked about loan forgiveness. I have two friends who are married. They're a couple. They're $500,000 in debt or more because of their education. And they're looking into the National Health Service Corps. The most lucrative program within the National Health Service Corps requires you to commit to 3 years of work in one clinic. And the qualifications or the criteria for that clinic change every year, and the job market is unpredictable each year. And so there's no guarantee that when they graduate from residency that they're going to find two jobs that meet the criteria for the National Health Service Corps in the same area. And that's too much of a risk for them to take, and it's too bad because they are passionate about primary care and public health. But they might have to move far from their family. They might have to live far from each other, and that's just not going to work for them, so they're not going to go. And finally, we could talk about large corporations and third-party payers that could invest in primary care, because if there are any two healthcare stakeholders that have both tremendous stake in this program and tremendous power to leverage, it's these large employers in the state. And with all of the Fortune 500 companies in the region, why not reach out to them and get them to start leveraging some of that power? And I think I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you. I will say... we have done stuff starting in 2008, and actually started the implementation in 2010, which is to change the way we pay for health care and to start to pay for outcomes rather than fee-for-service. And one of those things we did was the medical homes or health care homes. And just this year, the Department of Health has come out with a study on the implementation of that, and we are saving 9% of the cost of MA because of the medical home, which is a team approach to, and that's mainly primary care. So, but I agree with you. We have to change the payment system to reward what we really want, which is outcomes. Any questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you all for your comments. You're in the thick of it, so it gives us a unique perspective that is very, very important. Probably one of my... I hear you talking about the five... You know, there's several things. The five-year is important because I know when we've talked about this, we want to be sure there's a hold... not just 1 or 2 years and then we lose them. We want to make sure that they're actually out there in the rural thing. And I thought it was interesting on the tax credit for preceptors. But it's interesting, the enthusiasm. I don't know how you generate greater enthusiasm. That's except maybe the tax credit will help enthusiasm. Sometimes that does. And the loan forgiveness. But I think that over the past couple generations, and we've talked about this, one of the greatest disruptors to primary care has been the networks. Because I've seen people have a relationship with a primary care doc, and then the in-network changes, and that doctor is no longer in-network. It has increased costs because they're having to, when they go to a new network, then they've got to establish a baseline again and do all these assessments and tests because they won't take another clinic's records. Maybe that'll change with an e-record. I don't know. Could you, any of you, just comment on this whole in-network, out-of-network continuity? Because the real value in primary care is continuity. And I think the satisfaction that comes from being a primary doc is continuity. Being able, so could you comment on that area of how that affects what you think about primary care?
Well, I get, as I sort of said, when I was did my my clinic, continuity clinic in residency, my continuity with my patients wasn't ideal, and I really sort of hoped that it would be better. You know, you almost develop almost friendships with patients after a while, and I think that I've anecdotally had patients talk about, I had this great primary doc that I love, and now my health partner's insurance has limited me to this one place. And when I was a first-year medical student, we used to take buses, and the first day we would go, I don't know if they still do it, I went to Grand Rapids just to tour a small town in Minnesota. And during that time, the Itasca Clinic in Grand Rapids was battling with, I think, Blue Cross about prices over various services. And the paper mill in Grand Rapids was Blue Cross. And so most of the community couldn't go to the hospital that had just been built in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, people were driving, you know, an hour more to go see a doctor. And so I think that that was real hardship for that community. So as far as solutions to it, I don't know that I have any insight into it, but I agree that it's a problem. I think people should, at least for primary care services, maybe specialty care is different, but for primary care it would seem that if you develop a relationship with someone who's easy to get to, that would be a definite benefit.
Yeah.
Chair and Senator Goodmeyer, I would agree.
Okay.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that you'll probably want to re-ask that question to Dr. Mackin and Dr. Running Hawk, who are coming up after us from United Family Medicine. Dr. Mackin has been a community physician for 30-plus years, and she has a ton of experience in that area, so she might be able to offer some insights. From a student perspective, that's one of the biggest things you think about with primary care is developing that longitudinal relationship with patients. And if the system is breaking that relationship, that's another disincentive to go into the field. If you can't even keep a relationship with your patient, what are we doing? You know, why am I doing this then?
Mm-hmm. Removing some of that.
I would agree, you know, and mm-hmm. My wife and I are very unusual. We've had the same primary care doc for 30-plus years. Mm-hmm. All my friends in the Twin Cities, they change every 2 years. You know, something changes. And
I like, Mr. Chairman, I kind of like that idea of, in the specialty practices, it's more of an experience situation. You fix the knee or you take care of a certain area. But primary care, and I don't know legislatively if we can exempt or do something so that when it comes to primary care, we by legislative policy, and so Mr. Schoenbaum, maybe we could take a look at what current state laws would hinder the ability for especially primary care to have that continuity no matter where you're at. And those are more apt to be the, those issues I think are something that I feel is a big hindrance to our goals. So I didn't want to miss the opportunity that we recruit them in and then we unwittingly have other things that make their practice very unsatisfactory or hinder patients from being able to have that continuity, because I think it is important. One of the things that I have found in I come from a little town of about 300 when I grew up. It's now tripled in population, though, so it's really growing. And, yeah, it's always interesting. But what has always amazed me is the mindset of the rural. They tend to, me be a doctor, me be a something like that. And so, and yet, some of our most hardworking, some of our most diligent folks come out of that. And I just think that there is, when we talk about this recruiting sometimes or focusing on that, there's a lot of the kids who are exceptionally well-qualified, smart kids, but their mindset is, I'm from a little town, so I can't have a big aspiration. I know that because I was one of them. And my uncle was Attorney General, and I wanted so bad to kind of, I admired him to be like him, but I didn't know how. But I remember having that mindset, I'm just from this little town. So I think it's an insidious mindset, and yet some of our, probably some of our best rural docs will be similar to what Ms. Johnson talked about, some of that passion. So when we do some of our loan forgiveness or some of these things, again, Mr. Schoenbaum, if we can, what are some possible options for us to look at how can we, on a real tangible way, on some of these early school or early recruiting or something like that, have a little bit of extra focus? Because I think it's so easy for the bigger schools, the bigger high schools, to be more competitive in reaching out for some of these grants or some of these things. So they're just bigger and they tend to have some of that. Whereas some of these small rural schools, they're just doing their thing. But I know that through legislation, we can sometimes help to divvy that up between a high population high school and a lower population high school. I mean, we do this all the time and everywhere else. So that's just one of the things that I feel that maybe we could add to our, because that's the phase we're in, is building some of those recommendations and making use of the expertise we have here telling us how can we put that from into tangible, real, practical kinds of things. And I really appreciate that, those suggestions you gave. They're very good. Thank you.
Other questions?
Well, thank you for your testimony. It was very informative. And send me a note on that Georgia thing.
Thank you.
Be very interested. So, again, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next we're going to United Family Medicine Community Center.
Good
welcome to the committee, and why don't you state your name so
sure.
it gets on the tape.
Thank you, Representative Huntley and Senator Claussen and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Mackin. I'm a family medicine physician for 34 years since I completed residency. I direct a residency program called United Family Medicine Residency, and I have always done community-based health. I don't know that you want to know that much about me because I'm multiple generations older and people had different lives, but very briefly, I come from a family of the oldest of eight children of a postal clerk. Really saw this opportunity when not very many women did medicine. About 15% of my class at Mayo were women, and in my residency class, I was the only woman, of which there were seven men. I was really, really, really lucky, I think, because many people could do this work. To also have a good family medicine role model, but probably more than anything, to just have the recognition early in my life that all people deserved health care and also that this work was such a privilege. And I will tell you, it is a complete privilege. We do tremendous continuity in an urban area, I will tell you that. I see people I've seen for 35, let's see, I started residency in 77, and I see some families I've seen since 1978. So both rural and urban docs have the ability to do continuity. And, there's studies that definitely show the efficiency around that, the relationship importance, the quality of care, and the probably decreased use of healthcare services. Speaking, though, to the residency, which is, I think, why I was asked to speak, I think the outstanding students and fellows spoke strongly to the challenges and to what they're looking for. So I spoke briefly to the continuity, and it can occur both urban and rural. There's no question that there's tremendous challenges, and you all spoke very, very well to the working at the top of your ticket in teams. And I think being near the latter part of my career, I see that that is both the present and the future. That is where the challenges lie for primary care docs or other PAs, advanced practice nurses in primary care, is being able to work at the top of their ticket. I think that organizations that support clinics, because many clinics aren't independent and many clinics are part of larger health organizations, are looking seriously at how do you support a primary care person to lead a team, to be engaged in the population that they serve, to work in team membership to get the best outcomes. So much of the burnout occurs with tremendous documentation requirements, the tremendous paper requirements, and the fact that a lot of these things are falling on the primary care doc who could be in that room like a park bench, which is what we all love doing, is being with people when hours after clinic, as an example, there's hours and hours of documentation. So looking closely at the diversity of visit opportunities, from e-visits to telemedicine to group visits to primary care, patient-centered medical home, which we have in our clinic, are all really critical to evolving population health. Specifically, the residency, our residency was designed in 1992 really around working around a community-oriented primary care focus, so both urban and rural. We have 2 months of required rural rotation, or CORE we call it. Of our 113 grads, 78% work in the state, 50% work in rural and urban underserved areas. They bring not only their expertise as family docs, but their expertise in community-oriented primary care. I like to think about an example that we recently saw at a conference on population-based medicine of one of our grads who works urban, East St. Paul, with the Karen community, or the Karen community, and there's about 7,500 in the population. They see almost half the population, and they've developed a user, a Karen Community Advisory Council. They've looked at the percentages of depression. They've looked at the percentages of post-war trauma, and they've made their practice fit the needs of the patients. And this is done in rural areas too, of course. One of the things our program has done has looked at how do we make our graduates more flexible and useful in the rural communities. And to that end, we designed or looked at it in a research fashion, and our graduates and our residents said, we would like a fourth year of mastery rather than going to a specific fellowship in a different location. So we've been able to train people in policy research, in surgical cesarean births, in surgical OB, in more procedures by adding a fourth year of mastery. And it's very individually, the highly motivated adult learner, very individual designed, but has led to people having more extensive experience and skills in rural and urban areas. I know that training a resident is not an inexpensive proposition, and I know that we are fortunate to have both Medicare support, which is gigantic, as well as support through Merck and through through the state. We also have some funding. We're not able to train more residents unless, this has come to a question to me, unless we have more fiscal support, because we're really working completely at either a break-even or below that level of finance. And we're pretty fiscally responsible, I think. I think the key issues I would say are that looking at preventing burnout, which I mentioned some of the things that would be necessary, definitely team, definitely diversity of utilization of technology, definitely an improvement, of course, in primary care reimbursement. I did not have the debt load. I didn't have any money going into medical school, but medical school from 73 to 77 was not as expensive. So it was not a challenge for me to do what my heart wanted to do, and I've been very fortunate to do that. Certainly, residents do have tremendous debt load. We know that it runs as these good medical students and fellows spoke to in about of a quarter of $1 million range, that high. So they do have to think about all the debt forgiveness, all the loan forgiveness, all the opportunities to be able to sustain their families and have families. I will say that that I think our investment in what we've done has been the outcome of the investment has been gigantic, and the impact to the state is very significant, and we're very grateful for the opportunity to do this work. And we do believe that, you know, and this is just the physician part. It's not, we do also train nurse practitioners and PA students and medical students. And those things are not reimbursed for us either. Those are all done because we want to mentor, and that's true of most primary care practices. You get reimbursed by Merck, thank you, but you don't get reimbursed in another way. So we look forward to possibly being able to expand our program at a small amount. Perhaps that meets some needs. We believe it will in the state, but we know that really a key piece of it is the whole patient-centered medical home, the population health pieces, the community-oriented primary care. So we know that all of this is part of what is necessary to be more effective in population medicine.
Questions?
Yeah.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Dr. Mackin. Question I have for you is, how many of your graduates after that five-year mark are in rural Minnesota And how many at that five-year mark are in that family medicine have continued with
that? Good question. I don't actually know that. I didn't know that was a question. I would be glad to bring that to you. We have 50% in our continuing graduate pool. So those people, we are only 22 years old. So it's whatever that 18-year period, 50% of people are either urban or rural underserved of the 78% that stayed in the state. So it has been sustained to a great extent. Anecdotally, I could speak of changes. Most people do not change in family medicine to go back and do like specialty other than perhaps hospice and palliative care or geriatrics or sports medicine, all of which can sustain them in their same communities. So or adolescent medicine.
Okay, thank you.
Could you just describe for me, how do you teach both the PAs and advanced practice nurses and the family practice residents about the medical home approach, team approach to?
Probably by practice. We have medical home. We have a lot of work to do on it. We are doing it. We need to do it better. I'm just being forthright. It's a new, I think we've always done it to some extent, but to have like permission to do it and actually be able to be reimbursed a little bit for it makes it easier to do in a very, very busy schedule. A good example might be that we do several, probably the most powerful is a group prenatal care visits called Centering Pregnancy. So in that environment, there's a nurse, there's a CNA, there's a midwife who might come to visit, there's a lactation person that visits, all of which with a resident and a doc as well, a resident doctor and a doc as well. So that might be one example. We do have actual manager persons that connect to patients who are in medical home. Right now, the way we do medical home is we take the really high utilizers, the super utilizers, the hot spotters, whatever which you want to use, and we're working within the fund network as well, which is we're an FQHC, Federal Qualified Health Center, and all the Federal Qualified Health Centers got together and did an ACO looking at how can we decrease the utilization in ERs and out of our clinic setting and into doing a better job keeping people in clinic. And that involves everything from advocacy to, nurse follow-up visits to outreach to our PAs and our NP are all part of the practice in the same way. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Do you have social workers in your clinic as well?
Representative Huntley, we do not at current have social workers. We do have mental health, behavioral health, and we do have dental. We do a lot of procedures that people could otherwise not afford to have done, such as stress testing, et cetera, podiatry, other procedures. But we do not currently have social workers. We need to.
Any other questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always have lots of questions.
Yeah, I like that.
Question I have for you is, I think there was an article in the paper recently also about the electronic record assistance, and I think especially in a heavy practice, especially when you can have concurrent data entry. So instead of going out afterwards and trying to remember, for having mm-hmm. a series of patients mm-hmm. to try to remember, mm-hmm. and that also just efficient use, of your time. Could you comment on, do you have them? Do you work with them? How do you work with your doctors in making use of that?
Right. I think that's one of the pieces of working at the top of your ticket. So you're talking about the concurrent entrance of data. Some people are very efficient onto themselves. We currently in our practice have some scribes, very, very common in clinics you've been in them, I'm sure, where there's scribes or the ER, for example, We do use some scribes, and that allows people to focus completely. Patients tend to do very well with that, is my experience, a lot of times because their people, the scribes, are so interested in the patients too. But I think it takes some getting used to. I think there's a lot of need to do that kind of thing and tremendous teamwork with the doc or the advanced practice practitioner being part of this, maybe the leader of the team, but all those pieces being really important to deliver the care, such as, you know, a nurse and a nursing assistant, you know, lots of opportunity to do e-visits or there's a lot of chart opportunities where you can communicate by chart. They have different names. Those are all ways in which patients want to interact. They don't all want to come into a clinic. I always say in the COPC model that the people who come into the clinic are the numerator. It's not the denominator of all the population. And you want to get at, you want to be out in that community looking at the denominator too. And that's part of a team.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think that one of the things that we talked about was continuity in relationships. Mm-hmm. And so I've heard, you know, from others, and I've read the stories as well, that when we have our electronic records, which has some significant advantages there, but the problem is they go in to see a practitioner and they're busy typing in the computer and looking at things and doing that, and the patient feels a lack of engagement or relationship. What I've read and heard is that when you have a scribe, the physician can focus on the patient, and the gathering of data can be its own skill and its own entity. But more than anything, I think of a family practice physician, just as we've heard from the students here today, that's what they want. They didn't go into family practice to do data entry, but they understand the importance of a medical record. I mean, they depended upon it and they want it. And so, but I see that as kind of something newer. It isn't even on our substantial list that we even have. They're one of those areas. I appreciate your comments, and maybe that we could also look at Dr. Runninghawk, yes, also maybe comment to it when it's time.
Yeah, I would like her to speak because I think she has a very important and delightful story and experience to tell herself, and she is the present and the future, and I'm the present in the past, so a little bit of the future.
I'm glad to have you here together.
Senator Klassen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to again thank Dr. Markin. About, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago, I had a chance to spend a morning with Dr. Markin and her colleagues at the West 7th Clinic, and just a great learning experience for me, and wanted to share with one of the things I experienced. I'll call it a brown bag experience over lunch, where a number of residents came in, and there was a presenter in front, and he was presenting a real live patient scenario that he was dealing with. And it was a real learning experience as he shared symptoms and then reached out to colleagues about what their diagnosis might be, and it was a great learning experience. And we saw a lot of passion, a lot of commitment in the people that were there. And again, so again, thank you for that experience. I greatly appreciate that.
Oh, thank you, Senator Klassen. I will tell you not to worry. The power and the commitment of young physicians is very gratifying and very reassuring. I mean, these are committed, passionate people, very intelligent, very capable, servant-oriented people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Hawk.
Well, Representative Huntley, Senator Klassen, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. My name is Lacey Runninghawk, and I'm a second-year resident at the United Family Program. And I hope that you're okay with listening to one more story. So just a little bit of background about me. My parents are both from small towns. My dad is Dakota Sioux. He's from the Lake Traverse Reservation in rural South Dakota. And my mom grew up in a neighboring small town of 600 people, Wilmot. And so I was actually born in Ortonville, Minnesota. So I am a Minnesotan. But was born there because it was the closest hospital to Wilmot, where my mom was living when she was pregnant. So, and my dad he enlisted in the Marine Corps right out of high school, And my mom was mostly a stay-at-home mom as I was growing up. She had a home daycare, but was most of the time at home. And I think in a lot of ways I am where I am now because of mentors and educators that I've had in my life. My parents were always very, very supportive, but kind of blindly, not really knowing what I was getting into. I'm the first person in my family to go to college, first person to go to medical school, first doctor running hawk that I know of. So they were always like, you go, girl, but I don't really know what that means. So I kind of had to look to people and mentors to kind of guide me along the way. So I actually graduated high school from Pensacola, Florida, because my dad was stationed there at the time. And then from high school, knew that I wanted, both of my parents are from the Midwest, knew that I wanted to kind of be back in this area because this is where the family, the home base is, as we were kind of traveling and moving around throughout my life. So I looked at colleges in Minnesota and went to the University of Minnesota Morris, which is kind of a unique public school because it has a connection to a Native American community as well. It actually started as a Native American boarding school. And so one of their missions and commitments is to provide free tuition for American Indian students, which was really helpful for me as I was starting college and thinking about loans and scholarships and such. So, and at Morris, they also had really great support systems for Native American students and for people who are interested in going into medicine. So during my college summers, I had opportunities to, one summer I did a research program. It was called the Four Directions Summer Research Program that was targeted just for Native American students that were interested in medicine or science or research. And then another summer, I was able to shadow through an Indian Health Service internship at an Indian Health Service, actually where my dad grew up. And so that was the summer that I decided that I wanted to be a doctor, because I had a great mentor who kind of took me under her wing and showed me what it was like to be a family medicine doctor in a small community on a reservation and the impact that you can have in communities. And so I got to take care of patients with her, and then I was also babysitting her children, and then on the weekends we were designing a community calendar and taking photos of healthy role models in the community. And then on Thursday nights, she had a yoga class, and I could just see how she wasn't just their doctor. She was a member of the community and a role model in the community and really a part of the community. And I just thought that was so kind of motivating and empowering for me, and that's what I wanted to do. So from then on, I decided to go to medical school, and I also went to the University of Minnesota Duluth, as a couple others have on the panel. And they, as you know, have the strong commitment to family medicine, and another one of their missions is training Native American doctors, and so that was really important to me as well. And so just being able to be in a community and a school that there were other Native American students there that wanted to be doctors, because there aren't a lot of Native Americans that are in medicine, and so to have that support really meant a lot, and was able to learn more about my own American Indian culture and kind of create that identity for myself. And it just was more empowering for me to work in that community. So I actually had a scholarship for medical school through the Indian Health Service. And so I don't have the same debt load as a lot of residents have coming out of residency and going into practice. And so that has been really awesome for me. And my, you know, mission and goal is to work with the American Indian population anyway, and so having that support, that kind of fit exactly what I wanted to do, was pretty awesome. And then, so I went to the 2 years up in Duluth, and while we were there, as others have said, we have opportunities to work with rural family doctors, and so one of my experiences was in Cloquet with a Native American doctor who was working on a reservation there. And then another one of my months, I went to Ortonville, which is where I was born. And as I'm working with this doctor, he's telling me about how he's been here for, you know, 30 years. And I was like, Dr. Ross, I think you might have delivered me. And he's like, hold on, let me, he looks in his drawer and he gets out this book, what year were you born? And he found my mom's name and my birth weight and birth date. And so that was just like a really cool experience to kind of see exactly, you know, what family medicine doctors can do in their communities and to be able to meet him and see that he's, you know, still doing it and still loving it. So it was pretty fun. And so then I kind of knew all along that I wanted to be a family doc because I knew what that, you know, what the needs were in Native American communities, and it's to have good family docs that are going to stay there. I think there's a lot of turnover on reservations where there are doctors that come in for months at a time or maybe a year or so at a time. And for me, I really feel like it's important to train Native doctors that are going to stay there and go back to their communities. And so that's you know, kind of my motivation as well. And so in looking for residency programs, I wanted to find somewhere that I was going to, you know, feel supported and still have and get a good training. And there are a lot of awesome programs in the Twin Cities, in Minnesota, for family medicine training, good, you know, broad spectrum OB training, continuity. There are great programs. I felt like what stood out to me about United Family was that they just have a great commitment to the underserved in the community here, and also supporting people who have that interest as well. And so while I've been here, I actually learned about the program by meeting Dr. Rumsey as well. And so I think he's just an amazing, compassionate person. And then I came and interviewed and met Dr. Mackin, and I was like, and basically every doc there is they're great teachers and compassionate people. And so I have just felt very well supported since I've been there in being able to train and learn everything that I need to and want to be able to be a good doctor on a rural reservation. So a couple of examples. We do our two-month rural rotation, and so in Minnesota, there have been a couple people who have gone to Cloquet, which is a Native American site, and I had interest in going to Mille Lacs, and the program has been very supportive about allowing me to go there. And so during my two-month rural rotation, I'll be able to be on a reservation setting while I'm there, which is really awesome. And then the other thing Dr. Mackin has talked about is the COPC, which is community-oriented primary care. And those are it's time that's dedicated in our schedule as residents, which is pretty difficult to do, to be able to focus on a project in the community that we are passionate about. And they don't limit us or tell us what we're going to do. They allow us to choose what's important to us. And so I'm actually working at the American Indian Magnet School in St. Paul. And so being able to work with an after-school program that is almost all Native American students, and there's 30 of them, and I'm going once a month and just talking about health and wellness, and also, as we've, you know, heard from earlier in the morning here, just about what it means to be a doctor, how do you become a doctor, getting kids fired up about science and medicine, and hopefully empowering them that, you know, that they can do it too. And so I think it's a really awesome opportunity, and I didn't come across any other residency programs that provided that, so that was really important to me. And so I think, you know, thinking about recommendations for what could help the situation, I think having more funding for programs like United Family, and also just creating more programs like United Family, and having that kind of community piece where people can outreach into the communities would be really powerful. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And did you run into Dr. Vaneo when you were in Cloquet?
Yes. Yep, that's who I worked with.
I was on the admissions committee at the OMD, and when we admitted him.
Awesome.
I remember that very well. Any other questions?
I had asked before about the electronic record, and I think Dr. Mackin mentioned you could address that scribe assistant for electronic record data entry. If you could comment on that. Have you used that? Do you use a scribe? What are your thoughts about it?
As residents, we don't use scribes. I'm a pretty fast typer. And we have the opportunities to use, there's a voice activated system, Dragon and others that are like that, where you can kind of transcribe what you're saying into a note. So some residents have chosen to do that. I would agree that it is a challenge to try to, you know, be able to get notes finished and still have that connection with patients. But I think that's one thing that we're, you know, trying to get better at doing.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
I just tell you about one other person who went through the UMD Med School, Kathy Annette. I don't know. She was an American Indian. I think the first one from the Red Lake Reservation that actually went to a medical school and became a doctor.
I remember meeting her.
And but she's one of our failures because after 30 years of medicine, she is now the head of the Blandon Foundation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I suppose we can take a break for lunch then.
I think lunch. No, I think lunch. Is lunch here, Jamie?
I'm going to go check right now. I'm going to go check.
All right.
It should be.
Mr. Chairman and members, if we could maybe take 15 or so minutes and then kind of dive into our recommendations discussion. Probably be able to get people out of here early today.
Oh, that sounds good to me. Okay, we'll take about a 50-minute break for lunch and then get right back into business.